Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good morning and welcome to 42 Minutes. It is June 5th, is that right? And today I'm joined with my usual co-host, Will Morgan, and we're speaking with Michael Schott, the writer for the blog Goth Porn, which is an OG synchromistic blog that's been around forever. And he has a wonderful piece in the Sync book entitled Porn Star Jesus. But there's a number of Sync elements that have come together today that might start the talk off. Today is the second half of the transit of Venus, which I think the transits of Venus happen in pairs, and I think the first one was 2004. But so we have the morning star somehow dancing across the sun, but then Michael's piece in the Sync book begins on page 237, and so I have and his piece is all about the idea of the unconscious and the shadow creeping into consciousness with our repressed portions, you know, exactly what the shadow is. And so I guess that's where we're going to start. So good morning, Michael. Welcome to 42 Minutes. And how are you doing today?
Well, good morning, Doug. Good morning, Will. I'm doing fine. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Great. What do you think about your piece being room 237 in the Sync book?
Well, it's hilarious, but eerie and hilarious because I guess it's just par for the course. I've had a lot of really powerful syncs over the last month, and I love that today is the transit of Venus, and who is both the goddess of love, but also Lucifer, the light bringer, and I have no idea why those two are both associated with the planet Venus, but they are.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of things. I mean, I've heard actually Jesus is associated with Venus as well. And I've heard this from different areas. I can't cite anything now, but it seems that, and I don't know, it was probably about a week ago that I was reading PKD's exegesis, and he made this comment. He was like, you know, Jesus is a female. Jesus is a woman. And then he mentioned something about Venus, and he's like, I'm just saying. And there seems to be some correlation between the feminine, Lucifer, and Jesus, as if they're basically all the same thing or come from the same source.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about
that? Well, I know that in the book of Revelation, one of the last quotes, official quotes of Jesus is, I am the bright and shining morning star or something like that.
Right.
So he basically says, I'm Lucifer. That's the last thing in the whole book. Of the New Testament, so you kind of remember it. Isn't that kind of amazing? But I do think that, to me, Venus is both the morning star and the evening star. And when it's the evening, or when it's the morning star, it is sort of the herald of the sun coming up. So obviously it's the light bringer. The sun represents, let's say, the sun of consciousness. And so this morning star business and Lucifer makes a good amount of sense.
There's also the idea of when you get into this stuff, the duality, which is, so how do you have the virginal beauty queen, she's both the Virgin and the whore at the same time. And so you have Venus both, you know, the trollop at night and then the purity in the morning. So it's somehow encapsulate that, which is, I was thinking about this, how it, in an unembodied religious point of view, you know, sex is the wickedest thing in the world because it's so fleshy, you know, the desires of the flesh. And so, of course, if your spirituality, you know, is trying for purity, you're going to try and push all this fleshiness away. But then, you know, our creatureliness is going to seep into us, even if we're pushing it into our unconscious. And then we're going to, you know, have the world that we have where, you know, you have the Vatican sex scandals and, you know, all that stuff.
Right. Which is, that was more or less the subject of my piece in the Sync book, was that I called this sexual urge Eros, and who is yet another one of these primordial gods that we don't really know what the beginning was, but, you know, one of these creator, all-powerful kind of gods at the beginning. And so this sexual urge is so powerful and yet has been held, locked up and held down, and people are told that it's evil because, yeah, it seems fleshy and all those things. But you could also, you know, we think of a sexual union, that it's not, and in fact that all of life, well, almost all life on the planet requires a sexual union to happen, that, you know, it's not, it's far from an evil thing. You know, it's absolutely wonderful. And I got this. The thing is that, okay, the Catholic Church officially only wants anyone to have sex because for procreation, which means
creation.
Like,
recreation.
For procreation, yeah, to bring life in, you know, into the 3D material world, and that's its only use, which is pretty hilarious because the Catholic Church is itself like a 3D embodiment of something of a higher level. You know, the true church is you know, on a different plane. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
To me, is I just saw a news report where, I can't remember, I think they were in Switzerland, but these scientists basically said that they could tell a female's sexual history by the way that she walked. Basically, if that the more it depended on a clitoral or a vaginal orgasm, and a vaginal orgasm seemed to make the muscles looser and stuff. But to me, I mean, it was all like, oh, this is groundbreaking stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's William Reich. Do you know what I mean?
And yeah.
I'm very interested in William Reich and individuals like Aleister Crowley and their thoughts on, basically how the sexual orgasm is the source of all men's productivity.
Mm-hmm.
There's the idea of gnosis. So, but then we're getting into, like Michael said, the internal and external church, where the orgasm's like the embodied symbol of gnosis. You know, so it is the physical representation of the feeling of the striving. You know, that enlightened, the illumination. You know, you kind of need both. And so you can't deny one. So if you're a materialist, there's no deeper meaning behind, you know, you're just purely...
There's a reason why this goes down to the Beauty and the Beast tarot card. Is because of the bestiality and the beauty of sex, and why Crowley changed that to lust instead of strength. It was initially called strength because, you know, it was that interplay, that motivation of the beast power that was so creative, but Crowley saw through that and just called it straight up lust.
But so, I mean, like, our history, we've been trying to deny the beast for so long. I think of this living in the West of, you know, like trying to kill all the wolves. You know, they're competing with us as the top predator, so we need to get rid of them. But then it's like the unconscious that the predators sneak back in.
The viruses are the top predator.
Yeah.
Michael, what do you think about the concept of, or individuals who say that, you know, it was the over-sexuality of ancient civilizations like Greece and Rome that was the reason for their downfall, was that switch over from sex being not for procreation but recreation?
Yeah, I have no opinion because I don't really know. I haven't studied.
Do you think that that's possible? I mean, do you think that the over-sexuality is a way to devour a civilization?
I think it might be. I mean, the thing that's odd is that, say, for instance, in modern times, the Roman Catholic Church is being devoured by sexuality, but it's actually being devoured by this hidden, sexuality that they're in denial about. Same with the Protestant Church. So there's certainly this devouring going on right now. If it's out in the open, is it really, you know, I don't, what would be in the modern times, I would suppose that would be like a rock and roll culture or something, you know, where, you know, sex is out there all the time and drugs and rock and roll and you don't have any notion of restraint. So it seems to me that, yes, you can certainly see the ruin caused by an overdose of all of that, too.
Hmm. Well, in a culture with the right mythology or something, so they're in a culture that acknowledges those harmful things, they have the restraints built into the system, you know. So it acknowledges that these are necessary things. They're not evil, but they're, you know, there's part of the culture, but then they're also ritualized so that it doesn't destroy the culture. So that's interesting because of this book that I read called Sex at Dawn, where he's challenging, you know, we think of sex in biological terms handed down from, you know, science, that they said, well, this is how it is, you know, we're monogamous creatures and we made for life and this, but then this book challenges that and says, no, really, it's a Christian story at the heart of everything, and we're just questioning that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, even in the Old Testament, a lot of the kings had multiple wives and whatnot, so it's, I think the monogamy aspect is simply there in order to perhaps, again, help raise children or something, because it's useful, you know, culturally. But
or facilitate property.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And then speaking, you know, back to your idea of sex being the downfall of early civilizations, Will.
I just always remember there's a scene in Kinsey, and you guys know what Kinsey is, right?
Yeah.
Kinsey is the story of the psychiatrist who did, I don't even think he was a psychiatrist, but he's the gentleman who did all the studies on sexuality, basically charted multiple people's sexual habits, played by Neeson in the movie. And
right.
there's a scene in there where they're making fun of his dad, who is, what's that guy's name? The guy from Harry and the Hendersons. John Lithgow. Yeah, John Lithgow. And he's like, but the downfall of Rome was caused by too much bathing.
Too much what?
Too much bathing.
Because they had all those baths. Right.
Right. So it just became a big orgy or whatever. And I hear most of the individuals I hang around with are teachers. and we had a good out in the sun, on the deck conversation, drinking beer and stuff, and they started talking about how many more homosexual, there's, of course, there's always been homosexuals in high school and stuff, but they were talking about how flamboyant it is now, with boys bringing purses to school and stuff of that nature. And they really, they made comments. I just tried to be a fly on the wall, but they made comments about how they felt it was the media that was doing it, the, you know, Glee and things of that nature. And then we get into this stinkhole kind of line of thinking with certain individuals who do nothing but pick out these undertones of homosexuality in pop culture. How does that make you feel, Mike? I mean, can I call you Mike? Is that okay?
Certainly.
You being a homosexual individual yourself, I mean, in your own experience, is it possible for this to be programmed? Or is this the way that individuals are born?
Oh, I definitely think it's, well, what is a nurture or nature? My own experience, I'd say it's the way you're born, but the way it manifests is probably more has to do with nurture. So that let's say you're gay, and then you see, like for instance, I don't know how ancient we should call this, but American Indian culture, if a child was born gay, then it was determined that he was gay, and they didn't have any big taboos on it. But then he went over and lived with the women and wore women's clothing and, you know, did all this. And so to me, that's pushing, you know, a gay boy into a real stereotypical role. So, which is a shame, really. I would say. And so you get, just because gayness is so everywhere now, yeah, you get these roles and these stereotypes presented. And I think, you know, at a very early age, you might say, well, that's what I am. I'm going to act like that, you know.
Right. So, and that brings up a really good point, which is the difference between sex and gender, where sex is biology, and gender is this cultural construction. You know, our ideas of what a man is our ideas of what a man is. You know, it goes back to the story at the root of culture, which... is interesting in the light that Michael and I also share a liking for a series of books, the Ishmael books. And that guy is also challenging the idea of what mother culture is doing. And it's his assertion, in light of the Rome comment, that culture is doomed to fail because we're out of sync with nature.
Right. And he uses a gorilla as his, you know, mouthpiece, named Ishmael, as kind of the voice of reason from nature. And, yeah, it's the first time I read that book, man, I just bawled my eyes out.
Cried your eyes out?
Yeah, I cried my eyes out because it was just so powerful to me. I think I read it right after 911 too, so I was on edge, so to speak.
Well, I've been reading the latest one, which is My Ishmael, where he's talking to a 16-year-old girl. I don't... but, you know, it's more of that same how... How do we live? Kind of stuff.
Well, what's also interesting is you're a big fan of comic books. I noticed in your piece you mention them quite often, and it seems that you're reading them now. We were talking about Alan Moore earlier. And
right.
that's a topic that he brings up quite often. Homosexuality is a standard in his books, sexual topics, and there's a classic scene in The Watchmen where the Night Owl and I think it's Sally Jupiter.
Right.
Where they can't have sex until they're in their costumes. And he doesn't feel...
Right.
It's not until he actually does a heroic act that he stops feeling so impotent. But also, I know that the chief in Top Ten, I read Top Ten, the chief ends up being gay. At the very end of it, you realize that. I can't remember.
He and the redheaded kid have a thing going on at the end, and you realize that.
Right. So it's there was the old comic code that came through years ago during the Golden Age when comic books was a little bit too much sex, drugs, and rock and roll in comic books, and they made the code that no sexual act would be portrayed in comics and so forth and so on because it was, they said, influential on the youth.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it seems like, in your piece, you talk about Batman and Robin, and it seems like the more repressed that becomes, the more nefarious the portrayals of homosexuality almost seem. Like, to me, the portrayal of Batman and Robin seems more dangerous, because I can't really think of another word, more dangerous than, say, like the Top Ten portrayal, or even The Watchmen. It seems to me that The Watchmen and stuff like that, Alan Moore's point of view is a lot more honest.
Mm-hmm.
And the Batman and stuff like that, the other things, or even some of the passages that are in the Bible and seem more hinting, more... Go ahead.
Well, I'm just thinking that I bet that when they wrote, Kane wrote, Batman, that he probably had no conscious intention of duplicating a ancient Greek pederastic relationship so completely.
Right.
It just came out. And so, which is just, so that's one of my answers to conspiracy is you can say, well, look at this. Batman and Robin obviously, now that we know, is a textbook ancient Greek pederast relationship with a wealthy patron, a young, beautiful teenage boy. They live together. The one is training the other in the arts of war, et cetera. And, you could say, well, it's obviously a conspiracy, that they couldn't have, Batman and Robin couldn't have happened unless there was conscious design. And I look at that and go, probably not. I think it's a subconscious design, which is actually, this brings us back to the Black Dossier and this whole concept we were talking about who's writing the book, who's writing the monomyth. And this, the ultimate answer is, well, you are. We just don't know it. So,
So that's a great point. So, you were mentioning in the Black Dossier how you get the book in the book, and the characters in the book realize that their actions are influencing the larger book somehow, which leads the reader to the conclusion, like Bastion in the Neverending Story, that he's actually creating the reality as he's reading. So he's creating reality by reading the book, but then it's an active and not a passive role that he's undertaking, which...
Mm-hmm. It's strange you mentioned that one, because that was one of the ones that introduced me to this whole being inside of a book theme. For me, I read the Neverending Story, the Illuminatus trilogy by Robert Anton Wilson, and the Dark Tower series back to back. Two of those books, the Dark Tower and the Illuminatus, are, I mean, the Dark Tower is obviously influenced, but I had no idea that it was before I read it, and then all three of those in a row kind of snapped me into that way of thinking. And then you have movies like Stranger Than Fiction, and I think there's a couple more out there, but there's a theme or a node, a think node, that carries through that. And then the other day on Always Record, which is another extract of Think Book Radio, they were talking about the same thing and how perhaps the monkey movie that they watched called Head was actually written by Jack Torrance in The Shining. And how this double play of...
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, and so the thing about League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is that, which I've just been geeking on for the past couple months, and by the way, I was thinking, you know, I'm reading these books, but I'm sort of coming to the conclusion that they're having me read them. Is a better way to put it.
Yeah.
And so I The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is basically a monomyth construct because it collects all these stories and characters from different authors into one book. And then the Black Dossier is the book within a book, a story. It's sort of the MI5 file on the exploits of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen characters. And then so the characters get the Black Dossier and they start reading it and they realize they're reading a story that's all about them. Now, these characters never make the leap to think that, oh, there's a story written above them. But, you know, as we reading this, or at least me, I can't help but think that I'm also part of a story that is unfolding, the monomyth, and that's what's actually going on. So I'm reading all, because so this is the funky sync that happened last week. Okay, I'm reading the Black Dossier, and there's this little scene when Mina picks up the book, and she says, "Now, where's that dossier?" And she says, "I've got it. That's a nuisance. Something's tucked inside, have fallen out. Never mind, probably nothing important. That's the last you ever hear of that in the book." So I'd finished reading the Black Dossier. It was lying around for a week, but I wanted to write about it, and I wanted to scan a few pictures. So I picked it up to scan, and I opened it, and a piece of paper fell out. And I look at it and I see that it's a receipt to an art supply store here in Seattle, and the person who these art supplies were sold to is someone named Tim Schacht, spelled S-C-H-A-C-H-T. That totally made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. It was like the impossible. It's like impossible.
Well, see,
because I don't have the most common name.
Right. Works that way, though. Sync is, I mean, the way that you would write a story, okay? So if the villain is killed by a 30-06 in Act 4, you have to introduce that 30-06 in Act 2. Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to, in comic books especially, the villain always ends up being the best friend of the hero. And it has to work that way to be coherent to the reader, to make sense. Mm-hmm. So, Sync always gives you that feeling, like, why is this in my path? Like, what the hell? It gives you that, you know, but this goes I don't know. It's just tricky, and everybody's concerned with language. I mean, most everybody says that all of our perception of reality is based off of language. And in the Bible, it says the Word was God. God was the Word, meaning that God can't even exist without the Word, really.
Right.
Well, the word is that we're 30 minutes into this, 42 minutes with Michael Schott. And speaking of the word in the Bible, one of the really difficult notions to wrap your left brain around is the idea of how time is linear, but at the same time, there is no time and everything is, there's just the one point. And that's the illumination to experience everything in the one moment. And so it's like, well, how can there be time and everything's timeless? And how can I have, if it's already written? So this is how I've been conceiving of it. So a book, everything's happening all at the same time. Anywhere you put your finger is what's happening, right? So like a book is all one moment. Does that mean there's no free will because it's already written? And then I think about Jason Barrera, that the idea is to break out of the story. So
that's in Myth too, the Mutant and Myth book. He basically says that these individuals like Grant Morrison and Robert Anton Wilson and PKD realize that they're in a book, but also realize that they are the author and can change the story.
Right. I totally am starting to see that point. I mean, like experiencing it, right now. And that's where I kind of think this whole, the word Arthur is very interesting because it sounds like author. So it's like you could be King Arthur, and I've often thought of Alan Moore as sort of this Merlin character who Merlin has to come back at the end of the age in order to, save England or something like that. And so perhaps he really is Merlin who's returned, and he's chosen comic books as his medium to get his message across. I don't know.
Well, it speaks to a level of responsibility. An individual has to have it. It makes me worry a little bit. Like, so usually I choose media by the flow. And so back to room 237, sometimes it seems like the universe is asking me to enter room 237. And so do I deny this or do I go forward? And so I was having 1984 syncs. And so I started really reading some dark stuff. But then the thought is, am I making the world dark or am I just doing what the world is asking of me?
Yeah. No answer.
Have that same experience, Michael?
Pardon me?
Do you have that same experience? And then what do you do with that if you do?
Lately I've been, it's not so much what I've been reading that's been really dark. It's been the world itself is very dark to me appearing. And so, I've started to turn the news off because it just keeps getting more and more depressing. And it's always been depressing, but it seems like it's, more and more so. And so I don't get the depressing from the books. I get the depressing from the book I'm living. All the news and everything all the time. And I guess that's where I'm at on it.
Jack, as the caretaker of the Overlook, realizes how dirty and rotten the Overlook is in the basement, of course. So in Stephen King's book, he's digging around in the basement and he finds the records. So you have this grand, beautiful structure, that is high society, and you realize that at its core, it's truly rotten,
Mm-hmm.
But then in room 237, he opens the door, which is kind of a mirror to himself, and realizes that he is the overlook. You know, so I wonder if this isn't the moment that we're having, that we externalize the darkness, say.
Right.
Well, it's all in how you interpret it. It's all in how you rephrase it to yourself. How you read it. Or you cut it up, too. I mean, we were talking to the Wrong Way Wizard the other day, and he said that he had a spiritual event that happened when he was, you know, he cut into or mixed media. It seems to be some kind of, you know, this is what Joyce did, this is what Burroughs did, and this rearranging of what you're given seems to hold some kind of insight or some kind of key for a higher perspective.
Yeah. I was thinking about, you know, how ever since 2001 there's been this explosion of blogging and people having this compulsion to write. And I was just wondering if that was because the monomyth wanted to have a whole bunch of stories, you know, a whole, you know, it's like, okay, you're an ego, and you're, the reason you're an ego is to write a story. So sit down and everybody start writing. I'll choose the happiest ending, you know, or whatever.
More language. We need more language.
Yeah, exactly. More language. So I was thinking that, you know, this whole Trident thing is crazy too, because I've been geeking on that lately. Moore uses the Trident symbol all the time in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And of course, Captain Nemo, his symbol is the Trident in the book, and he's the captain of the submarine. So he's kind of like, does that make him like king of the subconscious or something? I don't know. You know, kind of like Poseidon. And of course, the Trident is like this, is this weapon that seems to be able to go from the subconscious to conscious. So it's not something that we as conscious people really want to experience, because it's generally experienced as something violent, like an earthquake or something. But it's something that the subconscious has decided that we need to hear about anyway. So I've been really thinking about this concept of a trident as being, you know, and I feel like I have a lot of history with this, because I grew up on Hood Canal in Washington, which is the home base of the Ohio-class submarines that have Trident missiles. And the Trident missile, of course, comes out of the submarine and blasts into the sun, just like a trident would sort of come out of the subconscious and blast into consciousness.
Kind of like Venus?
Yeah, kind of like Venus. So I've been fascinated by the fact that the World Trade Center's towers had all these tridents, you know, in the base. And then they were destroyed.
Sorry, I'm interrupting, because it's funny, because I've been, I don't know why I'm obsessed with the Triple Crown.
Same idea,
okay.
I think. Yeah.
The Truman Show delusion, which is started in 2008, which is basically this psychiatrical thing where individuals wake up and think that they're part of a dream and or a show for their benefit. If you read the Wikipedia page, it even says that it started before the Truman Show. There was a book called Philip K. Dick's Time Out of Joint about the individual thinking that he was being put on by his friends and family. But almost all of it has to do with 9/11. They have reported that one patient traveled to New York City after 9/11 to make sure that the 2001 terrorist attacks were not a plot twist in his own personal Truman Show. Another guy traveled to downtown Manhattan Federal Building to seek asylum from his show. I mean, what is that? Why is there a connection here between 9/11 and all of this? That's kind of crazy to me.
Well, my theory is that 9/11, you know, from the movie, inception. You know, you get the kick and you have to go, and that kick takes you from one level of dreaming to the next. 9-1-1 was that global kick where we all went from one level to another, and kicking and screaming, you know, by the way. So it was like the ultimate trident, or, you know, a Zeus Thunderbolt, same idea.
Yeah.
It's my theory anyway, for now.
How much time we got left, Doug?
We just have a couple of minutes left. We should mention that Michael Schott's work can be found at
godsporn.blogspot.com and themaskofgod.blogspot.com. Anything else, Michael, that you have online that individuals would be interested in?
I think that is probably it. So, yeah.
Okay, so did we come to the realization that it's all our fault and we're sorry?
I guess so. I mean,
well, that's where I'm arriving.
That's where I'm going too, and I'm like, you know, and I'm like, damn, I'm sorry, I'm a shitty writer.
Well, I would very much appreciate it if you came back on and talked to us again. It seems like, even though we covered a lot of ground in this one, I have no idea. Maybe it's the Venus transit, but it seems like it went by very quickly to me. I don't think we're done with you yet.
Well, it was my pleasure. I really enjoyed talking with you both. And yeah, I'm thinking of the transit, you know, now, to me, it's like the subway, you know, the Venus transit, and it's like, all these images of like the bus or the subway or the train keep coming to me, and so it'll be an interesting week, no doubt.
Well, let's see where it takes us, but that's 42 minutes, and thank you so much, Michael. We'll talk to you next week, Will. Take care, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.